I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. One of India's best-known writers, Amitav Ghosh, joins me now from here in Vancouver to discuss his latest novel, Sea of Poppies. It was recently shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and the reviews have been quite favorable. It has been described as sweeping and a masterpiece. Set just before the Opium Wars, we see a tumultuous journey across the Indian Ocean by an old slave ship, the Ibis. From the Ganges to China and points in between, we see a number of vast characters and a view of this colonial world. Sea of Poppies is published here in Canada by Viking and retails for $29. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Amitav Ghosh. Good morning, Mr. Ghosh.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
When does this story take place, exactly?
1838.
And where?
It's set mainly in eastern India, particularly Calcutta, but some of it also takes place in Bihar, which is to the west of Calcutta, and some of it is, a large part of it actually happens at sea.
And about the sea and about this era of time,
yeah.
When were you first interested in that? As a child, were you fascinated by the sea about this era, about this time?
Yes, I was. I loved reading sea stories as a child. It's always been one of my great passions. I love reading nautical fiction, and as a child, I loved reading books about the sea. And Calcutta itself is a famous port. It was once a great port. It isn't really anymore, but I grew up with a very intense awareness of the sea, of sailing, of ships, and so on.
The comparison to Melville must be quite nice for you, isn't it?
Melville was one of the inspirations for the book. I'm a great devotee of Melville's, and I really admire his work. And so it is very gratifying. Yes.
And they also compared the book to Conrad and to Tolstoy. How do you react to that?
Well, what's not to like? But it's a bit strange for me though, because Conrad, it's hard for me to see why the comparison would come about, because Conrad is really writing about the age of steam, and this book is very much within the age of sail.
What sort of research do you do for this book? For this sort of book?
Well, there was a lot of research, some of it was to do with libraries, and that was, that was very, very interesting. I went to libraries in England, in the U.S., most of all to nautical libraries. That was very interesting. Then I did a lot of archival research. I went to the archives in Mauritius. That was very interesting as well. And then, there was a lot of research about sailing, including trying to learn how to sail, and that was the most interesting part of all.
For you, was the research of it obviously sounded fun? Was the writing also fun?
Yes, very much so. It really was. I mean, it was absolutely a labor of love, and it was just a constant pleasure. I mean, for me, the writing is what I live for, it was just wonderful to do.
This book, as I mentioned, has already been a critical hit, and also a popular one. People are buying it and reading it, aren't they?
Yes, the sales have been really quite amazing, yes.
Well, this may seem an odd question to ask of the author, but why do you think this book has been such a critical hit and so popular?
I simply cannot say. It always amazes me. Years ago I wrote a book called The Glass Palace, and it was about it was about Indians in Burma. And while I was writing it, I thought, who on earth is going to read a book about Indians in Burma in the 19th century, I mean, no one even reads about Burma, far less a sort of small migrant community in Burma. But, that book did really, really well, and it sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and people were interested in it. I'm by nature sort of drawn to writing about fairly obscure and marginal things, and I never expect that people will be interested, but when they are, it's wonderful. I mean, it's you know, it's incredibly exciting.
As the author of the book, as the person who creates everything, the
yeah.
the plot and the characters, do you see yourself in any of the characters?
No, not really, and not at all, I should say, because you know. I mean, there is a sort of received idea that writers are always writing autobiography in some form or the other. And, you know, it's not entirely without truth, because in some way, you know, some little bits of people that you've known or experienced or you know, those things do get refracted into the book. But really the reason I write fiction is because I can make it up, you know. And so the exciting thing about fiction is that your mind can take you into places that you yourself have never been.
Is that the sign of a good novelist, a good fiction writer, the ability to make it up and not draw from their own life or their own experience?
You know, that would be taking it too far, I think, because certainly much great fiction is written, you know, in an autobiographical way. But I do think, you know, there is a sense in which when you let your imagination loose, and when you allow yourself the liberty of thinking yourself into other moments, other lives, it's a different order of challenge, you know.
Where do you live?
I divide my time, actually, between India and the U.S.
And why do you live in the U.S.?
Well,
you live in Brooklyn, right?
Yes, that's right. You know, it was a series of accidents. My wife is American, and after we got married, we lived in India initially, and then we had children, and she got a job in New York, and you know, we moved to New York, and then you know, we just wanted to give our children the stability of schooling, so they're almost done with school now. So now we are kind of moving back to India.
How much of your year, like how is the year broken up? Do you live most of the year in India, or do you live most of the year in the United States?
It's increasingly I'm more in India than in the U.S. But, you know, I try to work it out so that, you know, in the summer and in the winter, my kids can also be with me in India, my wife, you know, so that we can all be there together. And I try to be in the U.S. at times when they're in school, so, you know, just so that I can help around the house and, you know, keep things going.
In terms of identifying yourself, I mean, are you when people describe you as an Indian writer, are you hesitant at all, or is that something you embrace readily?
I embrace it very readily. That's exactly what I am.
And how many languages do you speak?
Well, five, I would say. You know, when one says speak, there must be some reservations there, because I speak five. I wouldn't say I'm equally fluent in all of them, but you know, I can make my way in five.
And when you're writing, when you're thinking, is it in English?
It depends on what I'm thinking about, because you know, my other languages do constantly crop up in my head, and people often think, especially people who are used to kind of monolingual cultures, think that language. You know, that the priorities of languages are very easily divided. But someone like me, who's grown up, you know, in a very multilingual culture, it's not that simple, you know. I mean, the languages constantly overlap, and they constantly enrich each other. And they're constantly in your head, you know. I mean, it's not like, I mean, every time I'm searching for a word, for example, I mean, three or four variants will come up in four or five different languages, you know. And that happens all the time.
People have written about this for years now, the sort of number of Indian writers who've emerged in recent years. You're at the fore of this group, you know, people like Kiran Desai and of course Rushdie and Mystery, and
yes.
And I guess your publisher David Davidar is also an accomplished writer himself.
Yes, very much. Yes.
What do you make of this phenomenon?
Well, I think the reason why people read our books really is because they're good books, you know. I mean, when I look around at my cohort of writers in India, I'm actually really amazed by the extraordinary quality of the writing, how good the writing is, and how, you know, how much it appeals. I mean, when I'm in India, really, one of the great thrills of being in India is just going into Indian bookshops, because you've mentioned the very well-known writers, but there are so many incredibly talented younger writers, whose work one can find on the bookshelf there that you can't find here. So it's a very, very exciting moment to be a writer in India, and the book buying public is expanding phenomenally in India. The book selling organizations are expanding enormously. It's one of the few places in the world where you go today as someone who's writing for the print media and feel really excited and vindicated, you know.
And you're well received in India as you are around the world.
Oh, I would say my books do much better in India than anywhere else. My core readership has always been in India. It's India that's always supported my work. Absolutely. I mean, my basic readership is over there. And, it's wonderful for me to be there because, you know, at this point in time, in fact, many, many young people read my books in colleges and schools and so on. And I would say my books are much better known in India than they are elsewhere.
Well, when you're in Vancouver today and you meet with readers and they talk to you about your books, and you think of the reaction that you get from India, do the readers react to the same things, or do they pick up on things elsewhere that they don't pick up in India, perhaps, or that they don't think about?
That's an interesting question. I think people do respond differently to different aspects of the books in different places. There are certain nuances that that an Indian would see, and there are certain nuances that a Canadian or a German or an Australian might see. And that's how it should be. I don't think it would be possible for anyone to read this book and absorb every aspect of it, because there are so many sort of plays upon different languages and different things, and people will respond to different parts of it.
Now, will there be a sequel to this book?
Well, it's actually the first in a trilogy.
And the other two, you're working on those now? Are they done, perhaps, or?
No, they're not. They're nowhere near done. I'm just beginning them.
How long did it take you to write Sea of Poppies?
It took about 4 years.
And during those 4 years, are you writing it the whole time, or are you working on other projects?
During those last 4 years, I was actually teaching for one of those years. So but I was just teaching like for 3 months of that. But other than that, yes, I've been I've devoted really, I guess, all my time to this. I occasionally write, an article here or something, but here or there. But apart from that, no, it's just entirely given to the book.
And in terms of your habits, do you spend all of your day, or how does your day sort of unfold?
Well, I've felt for years that I should spend less time at my desk. But somehow it just doesn't work out, I mean, I go to my desk in the morning and, I'm usually there till early evening. It's what I do, it's all I do, it's what I most enjoy.
And do you write on a computer or do you write longhand?
Now, I write, the first couple of drafts I write in a longhand, yes.
And then you go to a computer afterwards?
That's right.
What is it about writing longhand that you do that for the first couple of drafts? I mean, is it easier? I'm always curious as to why people write the way they do and how.
One explanation is that I'm really from that generation which was on the cusp of moving from the typewriter to the computer. So I was, as a kid, for example, I wrote in longhand most of the time. So it's something I'm used to. But what I really find is that when I'm, writing on a piece of paper with a pencil or with a fountain pen, I can be much more free, and I can, I can travel inward imaginatively much more easily than I can when I'm staring at a computer screen. The computer screen helps me sort out the language. It's very hard for me to imagine with a computer screen.
Does it matter where you write? For example, are you more prodigious in India or in the United States, or is it about the same?
You know, I think what really helps is to have a place that you're familiar with. You know, to have a desk you're familiar with, to be really at ease and familiar with your surroundings. Those are very important things, because otherwise the surroundings become a big distraction. But that being said, you know, there are three places where I have a desk and three places where I'm very familiar with my surroundings. And basically, I travel between them, you know. So it's just moving from one desk to another.
So, for example, on this book tour, would you be writing?
No, that's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. No. I mean, you know, even after I get back from this book tour, it'll take me like 10 days to just summon the concentration. Because writing, you know, it's an incredible sort of effort of mind, you know. It's not something that you just toss off. I mean, to regain that concentration, to regain the stillness that allows you to, you know, to form sentences properly, it requires a sort of tremendous inner discipline and a sort of inner calm, which you can't have at all when you're sort of, you know, bouncing about from one place to another.
The Indian Prime Minister Singh recently called for the reconciliation of the country's past with its colonial history. And this book speaks, of course, to the colonial experience.
Yeah.
Do you think reconciliation with the past is possible? And what does the book say about that?
Well, reconciliation with the past is, it's something that everybody lives with every day. I mean, you know, people go on with their lives. No matter what the past, I mean, you can hardly stop doing what you have to do because of the past. I think, you know, we in India have been very fortunate in that we had Gandhi, where Gandhi was always very clear that, you know, it's impossible to go ahead while thinking of only about injustice and grievances and so on. One must go ahead, but one must not forget, you know. The idea about thinking about the past is to make sure that the future is not the same as the past, you know.
In one reviewer mentioned globalization in the review, and he suggests perhaps that this is a good book to read so that we can sort of understand how to live with one another. Do you think that the book says anything about globalization?
Yes. In a sense, it does, because, look, the 1830s, the reason why the 1830s are so interesting is because this was the period when Adam Smith's ideas really gained a sort of popular purchase, when merchants and so on started actually using these ideas in popular parlance, when these ideas began to leak into, say, policy as well. So this was the Opium War was, in a sense, the first war launched in service of the idea of free trade and free markets and so on. And there's a distinct parallel between the way that the Opium Wars were launched, the way they were fought, and the war in Iraq. And it's interesting, you know, because it's, especially when you look at this history and you can see, really, these people who are talking about free markets and free trade and so on, in a sense, how delusional the whole idea was right from the start, because in the first place, what is free trade being deployed for? It's being deployed for opium. Today, even the most passionate of right-wing kind of free market people are not going to stand up and say to you, well, cocaine should be, priced according to the free market. And yet, why should they not? I mean, if they accept government intervention in that, why should they not accept government intervention elsewhere? So, you know, you can just see the speciousness of the argument right from the start. Moreover, you can see that, you know, these very same free marketers, they're the first to resort to the government when it comes to waging war in order to open up markets. And, you know, you see really both the duplicity, the speciousness of these arguments, and the, the double think that accompanies them. And it's curious that we're talking today, 2 weeks after basically this argument just collapsed upon itself like a house of cards. And really, one can only hope that something better will come out of it, some sense in which one recognizes that, you know, an economy exists to serve society, not the other way around.
To close, Amitav, I'm interested in your ideas on reading and your reading habits. Do you find that as a writer you invariably have to read, you must read?
Yeah, I read a lot. I mean, a certain amount of reading is just also background reading and research and all that. But, I do read, yes. Writing starts with reading.
And while you're writing, do you find that you read as well, that you read in concert with your writing?
No, that's much harder.
It's been a pleasure having you on the program, and I'd say good luck with it. You don't really need it, but indeed, continued good luck with the book.
One always needs good luck.
I think you're absolutely right.
You know, one always does. And I really thank you very much, Joseph. It was really great to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. The book is called Sea of Poppies. It is published by Viking. $29 is the price. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.